Our next speaker this afternoon is Andrew Janiak, who is a professor in the philosophy department at Duke University. He is also the director of the graduate program in history and philosophy of science, technology, and medicine. He is the co-leader of Project Vox, which is dedicated to recovering the voices of women philosophers. And they have some videos up on YouTube, where I recommend for undergraduate students to take a look at. So he's also the author of a book of Newton as Philosopher, and he'll be speaking to us today on the topic Amélie du Châtelet and the Scope of Physics in the Early 18th Century. Please join me in welcoming Professor Janiak.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And so what I'm going to do is try to talk about just one little aspect of Madame du Châtelet's project in the Institution, and I'm vaguely hoping that if I make a little bit of progress on this one topic, then we'll be able to apply a similar method. Method might be too grandiose a word, but a similar approach to other aspects of her text. I think, as you'll see in a few minutes, it's a fascinating work and very difficult to grasp in terms of the range of topics that she approaches and how the different topics connect with one another. It's just not at all obvious, and I think, as you'll see, or as you've already seen today, the tendency to think, well, she's joining some Leibnizian views with some Newtonian views really doesn't help us understand much of what she's doing. Now, we can easily say why people had that view. It's not crazy, right? But it doesn't get you very far into the work. So when I teach this text, I do certainly teach Leibniz and Newton first, because there are things you need to know to understand her philosophical views, but trying to see her as somehow bringing together Leibniz and Newton, I think, is of limited use. Anyway. So today I'm going to try to tell you a story about how one chapter early on in the text on essences, which seems to be on a very general metaphysical topic, connects with something in physics related to what Newton was doing before her. And as I say, if this makes some sense to you, maybe this approach can be used for other things. That's kind of the general idea. Okay, but first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some, to philosophers anyway, more obscure figures, just to set some of the historical stage. I'm no expert in any of this, but I do think the contrast between her work and other French texts in physics from just before her text in 1740 is somewhat illuminating, and what I like to focus on is the scope of these texts. That is, the scope of topics that they feel confident in discussing. Okay, so you probably all know the Traité de Physique from Jacques Rouault, and that, of course, was published first in 1671 and went through many editions. As you all know, it became famous in part because Samuel Clarke started adding so-called Newtonian notes to it. And, of course, there was this dialogue between the Cartesian-ish text and the Newtonian-ish notes. But what I want to point out here is just the scope of this text. So Rouault discusses, and I just chose a small sampling, a huge range of topics within physics, including planetary motion, which you would expect, the nature of air, water, and minerals, the human body, including respiration, digestion, all sorts of things. And the list goes on. It has a very wide scope, and of course she cites this text, she knew it. The same thing can be seen in these other, I've got a number of other ones. So one is a series of excerpts from the major journals of the time, the Philosophical Transactions, the Histoire de l'Académie des Sciences, the Journal des Savants. And again, there's all kinds of topics treated under what they call general physics. Sound, light, air, colors. The system of Monsieur Newton, that's a topic. Ice, water, you get the idea. We see the same thing in Hartzerker, who some of you know as a correspondent of Leibniz, probably, in his course of physics. And then this intriguing, obscure Cartesian, Joseph Privat de Molière, starting in 1734, again, so he's going to, of course, defend vortices as an explanation for planetary motion and also various, you know, so-called sublunary phenomena, but also the nature of air, water, fire, salt, very wide range of topics. So these all are similar in their scope, I think, and a hugely important contrast to Madame du Châtelet. For those of you who know her text, she doesn't discuss almost any of these topics. She's really very focused, as we'll see, on motion and gravity in particular, and lots of phenomena associated with gravity, and doesn't bother discussing these. Now, I'm going to make a speculative remark at the end about the difference between the scope of these texts in physics in the 1730s and the scope of her text, and it will connect with something to do with the mechanical philosophy. So the basic idea is these thinkers seem very confident that they can deal with, as it were, almost any natural phenomenon. Not necessarily any arbitrary phenomenon, but you could ask them, well, what? Tell me about air. Tell me about light. Tell me about sound. Tell me about motion. And they have some general commitments to, let's say, a mechanistic picture. It's an overused word, and people mean different things, but for now. And so they feel confident they can tackle practically any phenomenon in nature. You do not see this in her text at all. It's highly focused. And I think maybe that will tell us something about her more general commitments and how they differ from theirs. Okay, at this rate, I'll never get there. Okay, and I need to stop. Okay. I'll have to skip some of it. This slide is mostly for audiences who don't know the text. You can just sort of note it. It is very intriguing that she appears in the encyclopedia. As many of you know, this was discovered not so long ago in about 12 entries in Diderot and D'Alembert's encyclopedia because of the work of Samuel Formé, who was the secretary of the Berlin Academy and who wrote a number of entries where he copied from her work. And then they, Diderot in particular, purchased his entries because he was going to create a French encyclopedia, and it became part of the canonical text of the Enlightenment. I think Robert Darton calls it the supreme text of the Enlightenment. So Madame du Châtelet has been read for many centuries by everyone, although they didn't know that they were reading her text. That's just an intriguing historical quirk. Okay, I don't know whether anyone can read this, but I really want to pay attention to this. This is the 21 chapters in the text, and for those of you who do the history of philosophy, it's a fascinating mélange. It's not the usual, right? And you really wonder, how does this fit together? For those of you who do more of the history of physics or the history of science, it's also a fascinating mélange, and you wonder, how do these things fit together? So you start with probably the following attitude. You say, well, I need to categorize these chapters in some way. And so you might think, well, the first few chapters seem to be on general philosophical topics. You might call them metaphysics, right? Principles of knowledge, the existence of God, as they say, essences, and so on. Then you get into this kind of intermediary realm of space and time and matter. And of course, these are topics in metaphysics, but they might also be relevant to physics. But after a while, you start to realize, okay, now we get a tremendous focus on gravity for a whole series of chapters about gravity, specifically about what Newton discovered and about attraction, the inclined plane, the pendulum, right, projectiles, and then stuff on forces. So you feel rather confident in thinking, okay, the last bunch of chapters are on physics. And then, of course, you wonder, how do they relate to each other? And it, of course, is very tempting to think the first few chapters, a la some generally Cartesian approach, are a foundation for the later chapters. I think that's a very tempting reading. I've been tempted by it myself in my weaker moments. But I'm going to tell you a story about chapter 3 today, that I think makes that tempting story not so compelling at the end. That's my approach. And then, as I say, if this seems at all helpful, whoops, maybe we can come up with some other examples and start talking. Okay. Hopefully that makes sense. So let's move on. We'll come back to this later. Okay, well, I've already mentioned part of this, but I would like to spend just a moment on another detail. So our friend Kant has come up a number of times today. Some of us have worked a fair bit on Kant. And here's sort of the basic idea. We have been hearing a lot over the last 20 years, let's say, or more, about Kant's attempt to somehow bring together Leibnizian metaphysics, right, with Newtonian physics. These are questionable terms, but you can just allow them for the moment. In particular, if you look at the Amphiboly, the best part of the Critique of Pure Reason, if you haven't read the Amphiboly, you really have missed out. Kant says in I think, uncharacteristically clear prose, exactly what he thinks about Leibniz's philosophy, or what he calls the Leibniz-Wolff philosophy. Now, for those of you who work on Leibniz, you know that he was not really going to spend a lot of time distinguishing, first of all, his own quasi-Kantian pre-critical views from Leibniz's views from Wolff's views. But in any case, in the Amphiboly, Kant very clearly explains, you know, what he thinks about Leibnizian metaphysical views, like identity, very general topics, identity and difference, and so on. And in there, you get the sense that he thinks Leibnizian metaphysics is, as it were, the right metaphysics if only we could know about, you know, things in themselves. Let's just put it that way, right? And Newtonian physics, of course, is the way to go if you're thinking about the, you know, phenomenal world. And this is a very compelling idea, and so I think Madame du Châtelet is often read through this lens, namely those early chapters are the Leibnizian foundation for this Newtonian physical science. And it was very common, as many of you know, in continental Europe to think that Newton was lacking a metaphysical foundation. That's very common. In fact, just to choose a person at random, you could find this over and over and over. Malebranche says, I think in 1707 in a letter, you know, Newton is a fantastic mathematician. Now, if he would only provide us with a physics, then we could, you know, learn something about the real natural world. Okay, so there's a temptation to read her through this Kantian lens, and I think that this is something we need to keep in mind. It may be pressing us in a certain direction when we interpret what she's doing. I also want to make one kind of side remark. Namely, one of the challenges in studying Madame du Châtelet, at least in my opinion, is that in the Anglo-American world anyway, we have really ignored French philosophy, French thought, French science almost entirely from the 18th century. Now, am I wrong? No. Now, if you go to most parts of the academy and you say that, they think, wait, you study the 18th century, but you don't study France, or you think France is irrelevant. That sounds crazy, right? To historians, literary scholars. And so I've said this many times in groups where there are very few philosophers, and they find it really bizarre. Well, what do you study? As you all know, we really fixate on the first half of the century in terms of the British Isles, of course, and the second half is very focused on Kant and what leads up to Kant. And France is nowhere to be found. So I think one of our challenges is it's difficult to avoid this Kantian lens because we have not been studying, you know, Maupertuis or D'Alembert or even Euler philosophically. In the history of mathematics, there's all kinds of work in the history of science, but very few philosophers have spent a lot of time thinking about these figures. And that is a real impediment to our understanding her philosophical views. Because, of course, she existed in this milieu. All of those people knew and read her. Euler wrote about her work and thought very highly of it, etc. So that's one problem we have. So I can't completely fill that in, but I'm going to try a little bit to get us in more of the correct direction, or so I'd say. All right. What time did I start? Does anyone know?
37.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Okay. Just reminding us very roughly now, this is really from the philosopher's point of view. This is not from the point of view of the history of physics. As many of you know, starting at the end, almost no philosopher in the 18th century was particularly enamored of the idea of absolute space. And as many of you know, people became very fixated on this as one of the major topics in the reception of Newton's views, which may have surprised Newton if he had known that. So many people, Leibniz, Berkeley, Kant, Du Châtelet, are skeptical of the idea of absolute space. Those arguments are very well known. I don't have to rehearse them. Going back to the top, some versions of Newton's laws, on the other hand, had a very different status for philosophers. People were very, I would say, sympathetic to the laws of motion, although there were many formulations of them. Marius knows more about that than I do. I'm sure Catherine does too, and probably George. Maybe you all do. Many different formulations in different contexts, but not nearly as skeptical, I would say, as the reaction to space. But I'm going to be focusing on number two, gravity. I think the problem there is, in addition to these famous disputes that people have talked about a lot, like disputes over action at a distance, which of course exercised many philosophers in the 18th century, there's actually another problem, which is just figuring out what Newton was claiming about gravity. In particular, what was he saying when he said that all bodies gravitate? What did that tell us about matter? How do you understand this claim, right? This is, I think, one of the major topics that philosophers were interested in, and there was a lot of disputes about this, even amongst, let's call them, Newtonians. So that's what I'm going to focus on, and I'm going to claim that part of what Du Châtelet is doing in Chapter 3 can actually be understood in connection to this. Okay? That's sort of the plan. Okay. I hope this doesn't offend anyone. So I did spend a fair bit of my earlier career trying to claim that Newton was a philosopher of some kind and making philosophical claims. But I do admit that on the issue I'm going to talk about today, there is a problem, because he wasn't being completely clear what he was saying. And I think what's so interesting about this is that you can miss it if you fixate on some of the things a lot of us have thought a lot about, like action at a distance and some other issues. So the question is going to be the following. When he concludes that bodies, all bodies gravitate, or gravity is in all bodies and is proportional to the quantity of matter in each, what does that mean? Just simply, what claim are you making? It's actually difficult to say, and we'll see how, when Newton took the time to try to explain what that meant, it actually didn't help. It confused people, even people who are highly sympathetic to him. So this was not about evading a criticism. Okay? All right, so let me just tell you something about how this works. So we're trying to figure out, in particular, what is Newton telling us about matter? Right? Is he telling us that he's discovered this special new feature of matter that no one had ever known about before, called gravity, or you might call it heaviness, that all bodies are heavy, which is really quite amazing if that's what he's claiming? Or is he not claiming that something weaker than that, right? That's going to be the question. Okay, now, many of you know, in the second edition of the Principia, and the third, we have these rules of reasoning, or rules of philosophizing, I guess you could say, which get a lot of focus from philosophers for lots of reasons. There's questions about induction and different kinds of inductive reasoning versus deductive reasoning. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to just focus on the context of these rules and what they tell us about this claim that is number one on this slide. I mean, what does this claim really mean? Right? Okay, so let's just read this. People have read this a million times, but there are ellipses here, but the ending is really the part where things get confusing. So, those qualities of bodies that cannot be intended and remitted, and that belong to all bodies, on which experiments can be made, should be taken as qualities of all bodies universally. Right? And then there's actually a fairly long discussion of what other people were calling the primary qualities, extension, impenetrability, and so on, right? And it's in that context that he now wants to talk about this contention about gravity. So if it's universally established by experiments and astronomical observations that all bodies on or near the Earth gravitate toward the Earth and do so in proportion to the quantity of matter in each body, mass, and that the moon gravitates toward the Earth in proportion to the quantity of its matter, and he goes on and he lists a number of other things he's discussed in Book 3, it will have to be concluded that all bodies gravitate toward one another, right? So there's some kind of inference that's analogous to an inference that you've made, perhaps, or felt licensed to make in the case of these other qualities, like extension and so on, and he thinks you're licensed to make the same kind of inference. Okay, but then he was afraid that, you know, the Leibnizians especially would misinterpret this claim. So there's this caveat which muddies the waters. Yet I am by no means affirming that gravity is essential to matter. By inherent force, I mean only the force of inertia. This is immutable. Gravity is diminished as bodies recede from the Earth. It's a really confusing set of sentences, and it really muddied the waters. Why? Well, gravity is in or affects all bodies. It's a force that affects all bodies. Okay. Now, Rule 3 is about qualities, as you can see. Qualities of bodies, right? Things like extension, impenetrability, whatever your favorite qualities are. So that suggests that gravity is a quality of some kind. At least just the context of the rule makes that seem legitimate as an interpretation. Newton carefully says that all bodies gravitate toward one another. That's over here. I guess that's why they invented a pointer. Okay. Gravitating, is that a... That sounds like an action. Is that a quality? Not clear. Is it the same thing? Don't know. Philosophers do wonder about these things. Finally, he denies that he's saying that gravity is essential to matter. He's not denying that gravity is essential to matter. He's denying that he's saying that, right? But then you say, well, wait a minute. Is that what we were talking about? When did that come up? What's essential to matter, right? And then you say, what do you mean by essential to matter? I don't know. Not clear. Okay. That's probably enough. Now, just to show you that this is, I think, a subject of confusion in Newton's own view. If we go backwards in time to the famous correspondence with Richard Bentley, who's very sympathetic to what Newton is doing and is asking him questions about the philosophical implications of his views, right, to do the publication of the Boyle lectures, what we find is, I think, a lack of clarity on this topic. So this is a private communication, although it was published in 1756, so people knew about it later, and it became very famous. At this time, this is a private communication between Newton and a very sympathetic reader, let's say. Although, from Newton's point of view, not the most sophisticated reader, you know, but a sympathetic reader. And Newton says, very famously, blah, 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 right? This is why I desire you to not ascribe innate gravity, and this is written in English, this is not my translation, right? He said, I desired you would not ascribe innate gravity to me, that gravity should be innate, inherent, and essential to matter, so that one body may act upon another at a distance, etc., etc., is to me an absurdity, right? Now, most of us have focused on all this stuff about action at a distance. Well, maybe not most, some of us, including me. And so we kind of fixated on that. But I say, let's ignore that. I don't care about action at a distance anymore. Now I want to know, what's going on in this earlier passage? Innate, essential, inherent. Are those synonyms? Are they different things? Do they go together? Are they co-extensive, right? I don't know. He never explains them. So even in his private correspondence, when he has a chance to explain to a sympathetic reader, as it were, the consequences of his own theory, one of the most important consequences, right? Namely, what are you claiming about material bodies? It just isn't clear what he's claiming. And I don't think this clarifies it. It's just more confusion. And you start wondering, what do these various terms mean? And we don't know. He never, as far as I know, he never explained them any further. All right, so there's that. And then I really hate doing this because Coates' preface is one of the great, you know, philosophical texts on Newton. which Newton, I think, actually would have thought in some ways. He had a very high opinion of Coates, I believe. Someone can correct me, but that's my opinion. What we find is Coates, too, has got a very confusing view of what it would mean to say that gravity is essential to matter. And that's because he's got a very intriguing and confusing idea about what something being essential means. So he wrote the editor's preface to the second edition of the Principia, which many people read because the Principia was too hard to read, and they thought, okay, this is, you know, his spokesperson telling us, just like they were to read Clark's letters to Leibniz later. And Bentley, Clark, Newton, and Coates are all corresponding and talking with one another. You know, several of them are just in London together. Coates is not. Coates sent a draft to Clark, who advised him to avoid contending that gravity is essential to bodies because they thought it would lead to, you know, debate. And so he took it out. But here's what's confusing. Coates tells Clark in this letter that we do have the following thing. I understand by essential properties such properties without which no others belonging to the same substance can exist. Very strong idea, right? And I would not undertake to prove that it were impossible for any of the other properties of bodies to exist without even extension. Although, you might wonder if he really means that, I don't know. So in this case, essential is something we do understand. Unlike with Newton's letter to Bentley, where I don't think we're clear on what he meant, Coates says what he would have meant by it. But it's this very strong notion that the essential property of something is such that its other properties depend on that. So it's sort of like an essential attribute, it sounds like. Okay. And then in the published preface, which everyone read, Coates does claim that gravity is a primary quality, like extension and mobility, and also a universal quality, namely all bodies have this quality, right? But he avoids talking about whether it's essential to matter, because he has this very strong view. Okay, let's put all of this together. This is just a sketch. We could talk about this for an hour, as you can imagine, right? Or longer, but we have all these different meanings floating around at this time. Newton's meaning, Coates' meaning, etc. Okay, so here's a sketch of three different things that you can mean by essential, right? So one of them is very common. Essential means something like a property that we would call intrinsic. Now I know for those of you who do analytic metaphysics, I don't know if anyone does, we can discuss that, and there's compatible with loneliness, and you know, Lewis has this discussion with Ray Langton and all that. Let's ignore that for now. Though this is our language, intrinsic, right? Sometimes it's referred to as innate or inherent, although it isn't totally clear, as I say, whether Newton thinks these are the same things or not. Okay. So you can think here of the lonely corpuscle. So you take a corpuscle, you remove the rest of the world, the kinds of things philosophers like to talk about, right? That other people find pedantic, but we find meaningful, right? And you have your lonely corpuscle, what properties does it still have? Well, obviously it's not to the left of something, it's not heavier than something, but it has extension, it has impenetrability maybe, and if something's essential to it in this sense, it would have that property too, because it's intrinsic, right? Non-relational property. Okay, now Coates has a much stronger meaning, right? He's got this meaning like an essential attribute, namely, it's not just intrinsic, but, right, it's as it were the fundamental property such that the other properties depend on it, right? Now, saying gravity is like that would be really extreme, it seems. Like, why would the extension of a body depend on its having gravity? That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? At least, you can imagine why that'd be regarded as too strong a claim, right? Then you have another pretty basic meaning, which a lot of people really were interested in at this time, right? Was Newton saying that gravity is essential to matter in the sense that it, as it were, helps to make material things the things that they are, right? Like, to be a material thing is to have gravity or heaviness. And if you didn't have that, you wouldn't be material. Now, I know that's pretty vague, but it isn't the same thing as the central attribute, it isn't the same thing as intrinsic, although it could be that all the things that meet criterion 3 also meet 1, that could be true, but that doesn't mean they're synonyms, right? Okay, like I said, this requires a lot more work, and there's probably 20 different meanings we could tease out, This is just a start. However, I do think that Newton is not clear on which one of these he means, if any. And I do think Coates didn't help because he didn't really clarify which of these things. It would have made a great deal of difference if he had just said, you know, I mean gravity's essential matter in the following way. Or I don't mean it, whatever. Okay, so that's part of the background here. I'm going to run out of time. Now, some of Newton's followers wanted to say that gravity is essential to matter. And they wanted to say that not in Coates' very strong sense, but in the weaker sense that it's intrinsic, maybe. Well, we can get to that. But definitely in that third sense, namely, some people wanted to say Newton has discovered something about matter, namely that to be material is to be heavy or to gravitate toward other bodies. And this is a profound discovery. And to see how profound it is, I actually think it helps to think about the history of philosophy more than the history of physics, because, as you all know, many philosophers thought they understood what matter was before 1687, right? And they thought it was extended solid substance, or, you know, there was a Cartesian view of what matter was, or you all know what they are. Well, they didn't include gravity in their views, right? And in fact, if you were a Cartesian, you would have thought, well, to think of gravity as an inherent feature, what do you mean by inherent? Well, one of these things would have been some kind of scholastic view, right? It would have been like an occult quality. And you can see why Leibniz later says, it sounds like you're reviving the occult qualities of the scholastics because you haven't explained how gravity could be essential in some way that is intelligible to us and not, you know. Okay. So some wanted to defend this idea. Oh my God, I'm going to completely run out of time. Okay, forget that. And Maupertuis. So a quick thing about Maupertuis. Now here I think we have the problem that philosophers rarely discuss Maupertuis. I think I'm right about that. So I don't know this text terribly well, but my opinion of it is that he actually misses something that Du Châtelet sees. Namely, the question with Newton's claim about gravity is really, what does it mean? Right? Does it mean that gravity is essential to matter? And if so, in what sense of the word essential? That's the real question, right? And what he focuses on is showing his Cartesian, mostly Cartesian, but anyway, his readers, that they shouldn't object to attraction as an absurdity. They should allow it to be a matter of fact, whether they're, as George said, right? But I think that actually misses something from the philosophical point of view, which is, well, it's something is a matter of fact. Gravity is in all bodies universally, maybe. Let's suppose that's true. But what does that mean about matter? That's still debatable. It's still a question. Okay, so here's Du Châtelet finally. Oh my God. Okay. She points out something, many of you are familiar with this, that I think is very important. She says, well, look, first of all, in chapter 5, she notes that there may be empty space between the planetary bodies, but there may, of course, be a medium of some kind. Newton hasn't shown that there isn't a medium, as long as it is not heavy and provides a negligible resistance to motion. There could be a medium of some kind. Of course, Newton was curious about the medium, if there were one, sometimes called the ether. And she points out that if a non-massive medium of some kind underlies gravity, then we can undermine, in turn, the idea that gravity is essential to matter. Because it might be, now you say, which sense is essential? Well, we can go through the different senses, but it might be that if this medium somehow didn't exist, bodies wouldn't gravitate toward one another. That could be possible. We haven't proven that that's not true, or not possible. Okay, so she is partly saying that certain Newtonians have gone too far in their contention that gravity is essential to matter. For example, in the sense of being intrinsic, right? It might depend on the medium, so it wouldn't be intrinsic. But also perhaps in the other sense, namely, you know, what it takes to be a material thing. It might be too strong to say gravity is one of the constitutive features of material bodies. If it depends on a medium, maybe it's not a constitutive feature, right? It'd be dependent. Okay. So I think, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the details of how that works, although I think you understand it well enough for now. Now, finally, to the heart of the matter. So, why talk about essences in chapter 3, right? What's the point of that? Well, I think one of the points is, as we've seen, there's a lot of confusion about the question of whether gravity is essential to matter. And she realizes, look, if we're going to tackle this, we have to do something that Newton didn't do, which is sit down and talk about what an essence of something is, and what an attribute is, and what a mode is, right? Now, a lot of people have thought, well, that's because Newton doesn't have an interest in metaphysics. He thinks it's a waste of time, right? But my opinion is, nonetheless, it may be a waste of time in the abstract, but it sure would be helpful to know what he himself was claiming about gravity, right? And when he says, I am by no means affirming that gravity is essential to matter, he himself makes a claim that, in my opinion, requires him to say what essential is supposed to mean. And his readers never knew. They were just left in the dark. And as we can see from the letter to Bentley, he didn't even clarify it in private. It was still just an unclear view. Okay, so she talks about two things. Not the Coates view, so not an essential attribute, but first of all, essential properties are the things that make a body what it is. So if something is essential to matter, it would make it material, right? For example, a triangle is essentially an enclosed three-sided figure. Then it has features that depend on that essence, right? In addition to that, I think she also thinks that essential properties have to be intrinsic in our sense. I mean, I know there's debates about what intrinsic means, but you get an idea, like shape. Okay. Now, this might be what Newton meant, right, back in Rule 3, when he writes that gravity is not essential to matter because it diminishes as one recedes from the Earth. That might be related. You might be thinking, well, gravity is not an intrinsic feature, a non-relational feature, right? It's somehow a relational feature because it's sensitive to, you know, what's going on with this thing here is sensitive to what I do over here, so that then that doesn't sound essential in this sense. But we don't know. It wasn't clear. And as far as I know, he never clarified this question. So her book has, in my view, the virtue of starting out by saying, well, look, if you read chapter 3, you know what I mean by essential. So throughout this book, if at any time you're wondering, gee, is she saying that such and such is essential, you know, to such and such? You'll know. You can go back to chapter 3 and read it. Okay. That's kind of the basic idea. I need to stop in a minute, don't I?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. Okay. So there's sort of two aspects of this that I've been trying to emphasize. One is, we have, I think, her pretty careful analysis of what Newton has shown and what he hasn't shown. In her view, someone said this, I think Ruth said this, her view is that you often have to distinguish between what Newton actually claimed in his text and what various followers of his claim, right? And I mean, it's very hard to overstate, in my view, how many philosophers in the 18th century, you know, thought about Newton through the lens of some commentary. There weren't a lot of people who were working through the Principia from beginning to end. Famously, Locke wrote a review of it, 1688, and asked Huygens, you know, can you tell me just the stuff in the middle, you know, make any sense?
490 pages in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. It's very big middle with some icing. He ate the icing and the cake was, yeah. So, I think, and she refers to commentaries pretty often, right? I think it's so essential to our understanding of these topics that we figure out what source someone was using, like Maclaurin for Hume or something that people have discussed, because that may really color the way that they understand some of these key questions, right? And as a result of that, she's trying to say, look, he has shown the following thing: all bodies gravitate. That may or may not be dependent on a medium of some kind. There may be empty space, but there might be a medium, right? He hasn't proven that there's no medium. Now, if that's true, when you take your next question and say, okay, well, is gravity essential to matter? and you say, I want to know, you know, is it intrinsic to material bodies? Does it help to constitute material bodies? Or is it the essential attribute, right, which sounds like a very strong claim, the one that Coates sort of flirted with but didn't assert? Well, that's going to depend on what he's shown here, and she is pointing out that some of his commentators or followers or promoters went too far in what they were claiming he had shown, and he hadn't actually done that, right? And that is, I think, very consequential for this general question about the nature of matter that philosophers have wondered about for a very long time, right? Okay, so that's the first point. Bless you. Second point is, once you start to clarify what you mean by essential, you can get some, you know, clarity on this key question. When Newton said, I'm by no means affirming this, but didn't explain it, now you can get some clarity. So, one thing is, it seems like it's hard to think of it as intrinsic to a body. Would a lonely body be heavy? It's not clear Newton is going to be happy with that or even contemplating that, right? Newton is telling about the actual world very, very carefully with lots of data about the actual world, if you like, and not necessarily even contemplating a case that philosophers like to think about is, well, what would happen if you took one of the things from our world and, right, and put it into its own universe, right? What features would that thing have? That's the kind of thing the philosopher wants to ask. So if we're going to do that, if we're going to think about intrinsic properties or the lonely corpuscle criterion, it's not clear gravity meets that criterion. But of course, there's still this question, does it help to constitute matter? Does it help to make matter the thing that it is? You could still debate that in some ways, in the actual world, right? Okay, final couple of comments to sort of bring us back to where we started. I think I'm not going to worry about this, although if people want to talk about Maupertuis, I do think there's a very interesting difference between the two of them, and her view or her approach has a virtue that his seems to lack, according to me, anyway. Okay, so now on to the sort of final point. So I was saying at the beginning that it's very tempting to view these first few chapters as dealing with metaphysical topics that provide a foundation for the physical topics at the end, right? Now, of course, like the word essential, the word foundation can be used in a lot of different ways. And so I don't sit here and say she doesn't have a metaphysical foundation for physics per se, because you might mean different things by that, and in some ways she may have a metaphysical. But what I do want to say is, if you look at chapter 3, and then you see how she deals with Newton's discoveries of in 15 and 16, and the question of attraction, which is the question people were interested in, and Maupertuis talks about in a whole, there's a whole chapter in the discourse from 1732 devoted to this topic. If you see how those connect, it seems to me that her discussion of essences, right, which in one context would just be kind of a general metaphysical topic, right, in this context, in this work, helps her to systematically deal with a question in physics. Namely, what does it mean to say that all bodies gravitate, right? And my view is Maupertuis seems to not be worried about that. He's worried about the fact that, you know, many people in France, or on the continent actually, you should say on the continent, are sort of philosophically opposed to Newton and can't see past their commitments to some kind of very narrow mechanistic thinking, and as a result, they just think attraction's an absurdity, and they won't, you know, they won't bother to endorse an empirical program to figure out further how to understand it, right? But her view, I think, has the virtue that it's saying, look, there's a prior question, namely, what is Newton claiming about gravity? He himself doesn't clarify it, I think. Philosophers want to know what the claim is really amounting to, and chapter 3 helps us to get clearer on that topic. So it answers a question in physics. It's not a separate metaphysical topic. It's not really a foundation, at least in some of the obvious senses of the word foundation. It's a way to have a more systematic approach to physics. Okay, and I think I have a minute or two. All right, so back to the beginning. What's the scope of her analysis? Well, just to remind you, she is not dealing with this huge range of topics you find in Molière or in, whenever I say Molière, people think I'm talking about the playwright, Joseph Privat de Molière, or in Rouault. She doesn't have, you could call it metaphysical or philosophical foundation or commitment that licenses her to deal with, you know, a vast range of topics, right? She's really very narrowly focused on space, time, motion, matter, forces, and gravity, right? Especially gravity. There's a huge focus on gravity in the final chapters. And my opinion is, if we look at this background from Newton and Coates and so on, we see that if you're focused on gravity, there's this major question that's left open. And the early discussions, like the chapter on essence, chapter 3, help her to answer this question in a more systematic way than you get even in Newton or Coates or Bentley, for that matter. Okay. At the same time, she avoids some of the excesses of Newton's more enthusiastic followers who make a claim she thinks is not licensed by his argument for universal gravity in Book 3. So it has that virtue, too. And I think that's probably enough. So thank you very much.